Good evening and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back.
You are listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, with your hosts Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome once again to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. I'm Willie Hassel, along with the lovely, the mystical, the mysterious Lynn Nickerson. Good evening.
Good evening, Willie. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah, good. Beautiful day today.
It's been a lovely few days, hasn't it?
It's a couple of weeks now. This is amazing. It's
New England Indian summer.
The 10-day forecast has got lots of sunshine in it.
Yeah, say next 5 days sunny.
Yeah, well, or 5, 10, whatever. At least a couple.
Well, they're never accurate 10 days out. You know
no,
that.
No, I know. 10 days is just a guess. But hey, I don't know about you, but I saw a great show Sunday.
I bet I'm going to hear about it. What was it?
You want to hear about it? I thought I saw you there.
I think I'm going to hear about it.
I think you're going to hear about it. Cold Spring Harbor.
Oh, I thought you meant a TV show reason.
No.
Oh, concert.
Great concert.
Yes.
Cold Spring Harbor, they came up and raised some money for us at the James House.
That was really a fun time. And they are such an excellent band.
They are. They are very, very good.
So yes, they did a good job, and we made a little money for James House.
Yep.
In Hampton, New Hampshire.
And everybody was happy.
Yeah, everybody was happy. Everybody left singing and dancing.
Yeah, everybody was happy. I'm not too sure about their equipment, though. I thought for a while there that everything got fried, but
it wasn't really their fault. It was source of the electricity.
It was nobody's fault. I think it was the ghosts inside the, because they're from
stolen. We got retribution for stolen electricity.
No, that was ours.
We were tapping into the pole. Yeah, no, we'll get charged for it. That's for sure.
Yeah. Hey, instead of complaining about the electricity, shall I introduce tonight's guest?
Why don't we do that?
Okay, tonight on Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, Alexander Petikoff. He was on once before. This is his second appearance. He was born in South Africa, but he grew up here in the United States. And he is a 2015 Quinnipiac University graduate with a BA in communications and minors in history and political science. And he currently resides here in New England, but he travels all across the United States and the world. He has looked into various
cryptozoological
creatures, such as Sasquatch, the Loch Ness Monster, the Lake Champlain Monster, mystery big cats, as well as other phenomena in mysterious places ranging from the paranormal Bridgewater Triangle of Massachusetts to the Hermit Kingdom of North Korea. And he has created short documentary films and a series on these subjects, among many others. And he is also an avid outdoorsman, hiker, and camper. And so, welcome to Spirit Radio, Alexander Petikoff. Good evening.
Good evening, Alexander.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us.
Next time it'll be in the studio, hopefully, if you don't have to work the next day.
that's just the tough part of scheduling it, the
long drive.
I know. It's kind of a tough time of night for a lot of people.
Well, maybe you can get your schedule changed.
hopefully at some point.
Break their arm.
Before we get into the paranormal stuff, I want to congratulate you on your recent 40 peaks?
40 mountaintops.
40 peaks over 4,000 feet?
48.
48. Oh, okay. That is quite an accomplishment.
Thank you very much. It was a pretty great time. It was a 2-year journey. I started about end of May, June 2017. I only had 2 4,000 foot mountains under my belt up until that point.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool to finish it off just back in August and feel accomplished, and now moving on to the New England 67. So.
Oh, okay, but 48 in 2 years, that's a lot of hiking.
Yeah, we did a lot. We were hiking, in the summers especially, we were really busting them out 1-2 a weekend. Some of them you can do more than one in one.
Yeah.
Other ones are solo, so, we did a lot of hiking. So it was a good journey, and you get the hiking bug. And I'm really an outdoorsman, and I really love just being outside, and it was an amazing time. I got to see those mountains in all kinds of conditions, snowy, sunny, sunrise, sunset, stars, Milky Way, just everything. It was just incredible.
And some beautiful pictures you brought back, too.
Yeah, that was, as a photographer, that was just a blessing to see some of those certain conditions that most people aren't up there at 5 a.m. to see the sun when it's just coming out blood red on the horizon, and you're on top of a 4,000 foot mountain. It really was special.
You must have camped out then.
Oh yeah, we did many a trek where it was an overnight.
Oh my gosh.
Or we would, a lot of the times we would do just sunrise hikes where we would camp out the night before and then get to the trailhead at 3 a.m. start hiking up and be up there by 6, hopefully, for the sunrise. A couple times we missed it, because some hikes are a lot tougher than others.
Oh, yeah.
Overall, it was, there was just a ton of different conditions, and times where there was a hefty hike and no view, because the whites.
Yeah.
Mountains are known for their terrible weather and unpredictable weather. So
yeah.
Very
yeah.
taxing.
Sorry?
Very strenuous and physically taxing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I went through a phase where last fall I had some, or actually 2017, kind of after the first summer I started, I had some knee pains. I had a friend also, he had some knee pain. You stop for the winter a little bit. I didn't do too much winter hiking, and then I kind of picked it up from there and kept going in the fall and the summer. So it was, it definitely takes a toll, but, once you get into form and into shape, it's amazing what your body can do and what it can tolerate, those 13-mile days where you started
13-mile days.
Yeah, well. I mean, it's amazing what your body can do.
Eight miles was always my top.
You're a little bit younger than I am.
But 8 miles a day was the best I could do. 4 up and 4 back, and that was it, and that killed me.
Yeah. That can be pretty strenuous, too. I mean, I've done mountains that were 3-4 miles, but you have an elevation, incline, tough terrain you got to climb over. It really just depends.
It being rocky.
The hikes is Owl's Head, which is like a 14, almost 20-mile round trip, but most of it you're just walking on flat terrain just to get to the actual mountain itself.
That's a little bit easier, the flatter land. But I wanted to ask you, being out there in the wild, did you personally find any kind of evidence of, let's say, a Sasquatch being in the area, or sounds, or anything?
I always kept one eye open for that, especially while staying out at night.
Mm-hmm.
Given that I'm very interested in that subject, I was in some of the areas I would consider to be the most squatchy in all of New Hampshire, probably. But I can't say that I really found anything that was, at least that convinced me that, what I was encountering was perhaps some sort of Sasquatch-type creature. I mean, there were plenty of times where you might hear a strange sound in the woods, but you can't conclude what that may be without sort of any further evidence. But, we found plenty of sign of bear. A lot of these camps, especially up high in the higher elevations, you're tent camping, you have to lock your food up in a bear box so they don't get in there or hang it in a tree.
Yeah.
We found plenty of evidence of moose, deer, all sorts of other critters, and I think with something like a Sasquatch, a lot of the sightings tend to take place actually closer to towns. I mean, a lot of the towns up in the White Mountains are virtually right brushing up against the wilderness, so they have bears, moose, all sorts of other animals walking through town and interacting with people in town, you know, bears digging through trash. So most of the sightings, you'd be surprised, don't take place actually in the very deep parts of the wilderness, because, you know, there's one little trail that intersects thousands of acres of woods that are untouched. So what are the chances that something may kind of cross your path? I think probably pretty slim. So a lot of the sightings do tend to take place in town areas that are bordering the wilderness, because you to have a sighting, you need to have a person, of course. So I kept my eyes open. That was for sure.
Anything in the way of paranormal or unexplained?
You know, not that I can really think of. I've had plenty of other experiences in other areas than the White Mountains themselves, but nothing really while out hiking that I can say. I mean, we always talked about it late at night and stories, and always kept our eyes peeled. We did hear stories of other hikers claiming to see UFOs or similar sort of strange lights that they would see up way up on the mountain in the middle of the night, you know, that were much too bright to be a flashlight.
Well, there's Mount Washington. It's not the only peak, but it's one in particular where hikers and those who work up there have mentioned the presence. They call it the presence, and there's something unseen that operates up there. A lot of poltergeist activity, a lot of strange things getting moved, areas of the woods where you get really frightened. And it's not just Mount Washington. I was very surprised to read of a couple of other peaks that had reported the same thing. So you didn't feel anything like that, huh?
Well, I would have to say, I mean, probably most of the mountains there have had in some form or another a fatality. Claimed almost 160 lives in the 1800s. So there's actually a high mountain hut up in on Mount Washington that's operated by the Appalachian Mountain Club.
That's haunted.
The Lake of the Clouds. I've stayed up there on occasion, and the crew, as they call them, the caretakers that work there during the summer seasons, summer season, claim that it's haunted. That they have ghosts and other presences. But a lot of the peaks have had fatalities. There's actually a mountain called Willie or Wiley. I never know. Everyone has a different pronunciation of that mountain, which is right in Crawford Notch. There was actually a story of the reason why it's called the Mount Wiley is because there was a family there that was their last name, and they had built a home.
Right.
And had a little shelter to escape avalanches. And what actually happened was, I believe this was in the 19th century, where they were. An avalanche of rocks was coming down from the mountain, and they fled from their home into this shelter that they specifically had built to kind of get away from the house in the case of an avalanche. Well, their home wasn't harmed at all, and ironically and tragically, the shelter that they were hiding in was actually crushed by rocks, and the entire family was killed there.
Very sad,
and some people claim that there's still sort of presence or a weird feeling on that mountain, and that's particularly brutal mountain. I actually did that in the winter, and it was a doozy, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, there's quite a ravine there. I believe it's the Wiley family, W-Y-L-E-Y.
I remember that came up on the show once before.
Yeah, very tragic.
So it's a pretty fascinating story. There's some other mountains as well that have stories. Mount Shakora, Shakarua. No one knows how to pronounce that one again.
Shakora.
You hear a different pronunciation. I just call it Shakora. That's not a 4,000-footer. It's actually just... I think just within like 15 or 20 feet from being a 4,000 footer, but arguably it's tougher than some 4,000 footers, and it has a much more phenomenal view. And the story goes that supposedly a chief had committed suicide, or his daughter had jumped off the cliff, or something along those. A Native American chief his name was Shakora. So there's definitely a lot of these sort of stories throughout the mountains. I mean, like in any mountain range, you have stories of strange things going on up in the hills, whether they're the fireballs seen in Berlin, New Hampshire, or the wood devils, these Bigfoot-like stories, or even the Betty and Barney Hill story, which took place right in the passage there in Franconia Notch.
That's right.
A very interesting area. Mount Washington Hotel, of course, is supposedly haunted as well. Lots of people have done investigations there, and even the Finding Bigfoot crew did a stakeout of the property there because there have been Bigfoot sightings in the area. So it's a strange area, the White Mountains.
It really is. I know it. A lot of stories. A lot of UFO sightings there, too. Well, getting back down to the Flatlanders, how about the Bridgewater Triangle? You've gone there, haven't you? Have you investigated?
Yeah, I haven't investigated too heavily, but I did do a short documentary about specifically Bigfoot in the Bridgewater Triangle, where I interviewed Joseph DeAndre, who is sort of a self-fashioned explorer, adventurer of the Bridgewater Triangle, who would go out into the swamps with a team or by himself often and search for the mysterious creatures and paranormal phenomena reported in there. And he would kind of dress up in like a safari-style outfit, you know, with the helmet or a Portuguese military hat. Very fascinating sort of character. You know, I kind of interviewed him about his experiences, and he had actually claimed to have seen some sort of Sasquatch-like creature in an area there in the Bridgewater Triangle in Massachusetts. And this is an area that's kind of south of Boston.
Right.
Coined in the 1970s by world-renowned cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman, who you know, famously also covered the Dover Demon and other cases in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bridgewater Triangle was sort of an amalgamation of all sorts of different strange things and stories. You know, the Hockomock Swamp was this cursed sort of swamp by the Wampanoag tribe. You've got the stories of the Puckwudgies and war with the English settlers that ended up terribly with a curse on the land. Dighton Rock, Bigfoot stuff, winged creatures, orbs seen in the swamp, ghost truckers. I mean, there's virtually everything in there.
Right.
If you're interested in paranormal or cryptozoological, you can find some sort of manifestation of it in this sort of area. And I think it's taken up on a legend of its own, which, you know, in itself can be interesting, but can also be a cautionary tale because an area like the Bridgewater Triangle, so high profile now. I mean, I believe there's even a TV studio, a major network that's developing some sort of a show based around it, a fictional show, so not like a reality TV show.
Well, this guy you interviewed, did he have anything to say of a personal nature about the Puckwudgies?
Not about that specifically.
No?
He had talked about just mostly Bigfoot and where he had a visual encounter.
Oh.
And he had also had a time when a few instances where they were camping and had a very large log thrown in their direction.
Ooh.
That scared them out. And another occasion where something screamed, where he described it like a creature, you know, some sort of god-awful, blood-curdling scream.
Yeah.
They're both sort of things that are reported with a lot of Sasquatch or Bigfoot sort of encounters. So very interesting. But what puzzled him was the fact that this area, you know, as small as it was, could support something so large. This is indeed a flesh and blood sort of creature, so that's an interesting factor. But there have been plenty of sightings, and there continue to be sightings. You know, I've been down there with members of Squatchachusetts, famous sort of, you know, well-known group of guys in Massachusetts
mm-hmm.
investigate the Bigfoot phenomena, and following up on sort of witness reports and the stories where guys are getting scared out of the woods by something screaming at them. And you know, nothing on the Puckwudgie side, but that is a pretty interesting sort of story.
Yeah, they both are. Yeah, just the unexplained, you know. We still don't fully understand either one of them. Okay, well, how about Lions of the East? Have you finished production on that?
Yeah, so I'm still actually currently editing and working on it sort of in the post-production, so, you know, production, filming, interviews, that has concluded, but for now it's still in the editing booth, so to speak. And, yeah, that's really just an examination of the big cat, mystery cat phenomenon going on in New England, which is capturing a lot of attention, a lot of fascination about it, because it's sort of more mundane, let's say, than something like a Sasquatch.
Yeah, it is.
Monster. It's you know, and it's interesting because it fits very well into the realm of cryptozoology, which is not only sort of fantastical beasts, but creatures that are misidentified or previously thought to be extinct.
So well, could tell me, which ones have previously been thought to be extinct? What are they referring to?
So something like the mountain lion would be a great example. So you have, in North America, we have this species, Puma concolor.
Yeah.
It's a Latin name for mountain lion, or what some people call cougars, or pumas, or catamounts.
Or jaguars, even.
There's a lot of different names. It really depends where you go regionally.
Mm-hmm.
But this creature's former distribution was basically all of North America, with very few exceptions, and into Mexico and Canada, of course, all across the United States. But as people began expanding and sort of moving into the wilderness areas of the East Coast, they began hunting them, and mountain lions were becoming a bit of a nuisance towards livestock and cattle and people's well-being, essentially. So they sadly hunted many of them to extinction. By the late 1800s, there were very few. You know, I think almost every single state in New England, you know, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, have stuffed examples of what they call the last mountain lion that was killed in that sort of time period. And the problem is, since then, since that supposedly period of extinction, there have been continued sightings, you know, from the 1910s, 20s, 30s, up until the modern day, of what people describe as big cats or mountain lions with a long, distinct tail. You know, there's definitely room for misidentification. Some people see a bobcat or something like that if they don't get a good look at it. But what I look out for when people tell me about their encounters is a long tail, long, bushy tail. That is something that is not characteristic of a lynx or a bobcat.
That's right.
That really could only be a mountain lion or some sort of escaped exotic.
Well, you know, they all kind of migrate, and depending on where they're located, some of these big cats, because like you mentioned, puma, cougar, jaguar, mountain lion, panther, they're actually all of the same species. The coloring may differ a little bit, but I wasn't aware that the mountain lions had become as extinct. Even when I was growing up in New Hampshire, yep, it was well known that there were mountain lions out there, as well as bobcats, as well as fisher cats. So I was wondering, what is the big allure now about these big cats? Because the only thing, I suppose, finding a jaguar up here in the north might be strange, or maybe a black panther or even a black spotted leopard would be kind of strange. But, you know, these others are pretty much all of the same species. And I don't understand what the allure is anymore.
You're correct. So, I mean, like I mentioned, that the mountain lion, you know, its distribution was very wide, and they essentially look the same. It's that sort of brownish, light yellow, tawny color.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that it depends, you know, maybe in the desert areas of the Southwest, it will be almost like a chalky white color.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A little bit lighter. Up north, it'll be a little bit darker. It really just depends on the sort of terrain, but the same sort of species. They're just adapting to the different environments.
Right.
The allure with that is that, you know, these animals, like you had mentioned kind of rightly, that you just kind of assumed that there were mountain lions because so many people have seen them. I didn't know that they weren't supposed to be here as well growing up, but I grew up hearing stories of people seeing them, you know, and then I realized that, you know, as I started kind of studying a little bit of natural science in high school and becoming very interested in nature and biology, that they actually weren't supposed to be here technically because they've been hunted to extinction, so science claims. But the stories persisted. I mean, so the allure is that these animals are not supposed to be here technically, but they are here. I mean, we have multiple confirmed cases. I think something that also piqued my interest in this subject in 2011, when I was living in the state of Connecticut for school, there was a story where a mountain lion was killed maybe less than an hour from New York City in Greenwich, Connecticut, basically, just north of New York City. Not very
right.
The last place you'd expect a mountain lion. Well, genetic testing on that mountain lion found that it was actually from a population of mountain lions found in the Black Hills of South Dakota. Its genetic makeup.
Meant
that this lone male traveled all that way east by itself. So a lot of biologists in some of these state wildlife and fishery department have begun to sort of acknowledge that, yes, it's possible that there are mountain lions from the western populations that are simply moving east.
They could migrate,
We've had other sightings in states that are closer to the accepted range, which is basically the Dakotas and the Rocky Mountains westward. That's where people interact with mountain lions on a regular basis, and there's large numbers of them.
You know, I can understand some of these animals migrating up from South America and Mexico, some from the Southwest, but what I do find a bit peculiar are the black cats, the panthers, the large cats that are found in the UK, with the UK being an island. Those cats really aren't migrating from anywhere. So where are they coming from? I do find that peculiar.
Right. I was going to mention that.
Yeah.
Just kind of finishing up my point about it being so alluring, I think it's because a lot of the states in this region, you know, kind of tacitly deny the existence of mountain lions, even though there's been very many reports. And I've actually, too, cases that are featured in my documentary are cases where there was DNA evidence that proved that there was a mountain lion involved in a certain incident, and those were shut down, essentially one by the state of New Hampshire, the other by the state of Massachusetts. And so a lot of people believe that the government is sort of in on it, conspiracy sort of thing. I'm not fanning those flames. I'm just trying to kind of both sides of the coin. I've talked to game wardens in Vermont, fish and wildlife people in New Hampshire, and kind of just talked to various people just about these stories because we want to get both sides of the coin. But within this, I'd say about 80-90% of all sightings of big cats in the East Coast area, and particularly New England, which is what I've been focusing on, have been what you would call the normal mountain lion, that tawny color, like I mentioned earlier. But then there's a small subset of sightings that are black in nature, meaning that they look like a mountain lion, but they look like a black panther in the sense that their fur is totally black.
Which, melanistic,
There's no known examples of melanism and that sort of pigment in mountain lions in America. So either there's something else going on, or mountain lions are able to actually... there are examples of them that are black in color, which is very interesting. That would definitely be a scientific discovery in itself. I mean, I found even reports dating back to the 1930s in New Hampshire, people claiming that they've seen black panthers in New Hampshire. But, and it's just one part of the mystery. So my documentary focuses more on just the big cat question in general, but it definitely touches up upon the black panther mystery. But I think that ultimately is almost a phenomenon of its own, its own examination, and maybe at some point myself or somebody else will do that. But for now, I think there's just a lot of, you're hearing news pieces all the time about people claiming that, they're seeing mountain lions. I just was sent one today, actually, from Worcester, Massachusetts, where somebody claimed that they'd seen a mountain lion, right around the Worcester area, which is very interesting. There's a lot of woods in the surrounding area.
There are, a lot of state forests.
The fascination is there. The fascination is there, and it's probably the most seen of any New England cryptid, let's say. Since I announced the project, since last year, I've gotten, dozens upon dozens of people telling me, and friends I've known for years saying, oh, yeah, I saw one of these things growing up while hunting. All sorts of stories. You just wouldn't expect it. It's almost become a sort of thing where it's accepted, like you said. People just, oh, yeah, they're around. We know they're here. The state doesn't believe us. And I think it creates sort of a distrust between the public and the state. And there's how do you bridge the gap? Or what are the reasons why there would be, like, potential cover-up? Some of these cases seem to be, without...
Yeah, it might have something to do with tourism, too, and they don't want to scare people away.
Yeah, tourism, public hysteria.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of reasons. Money is always tight with the government. And, dealing with a mountain lion is certainly a different beast than a bear. So you deal with a bear, let's say, up in the White Mountains, where they have a nuisance bear that's coming into the town and eating trash and isn't scared of people. Sadly, the state has to put an animal like that down. Well, a bear is a much different creature than a mountain lion. Big cats are notoriously stealthy, and they're the apex predator. So there's nothing that can really get to them, essentially. So, it's a different creature to deal with entirely from a managerial perspective.
Alexander, you're breaking up just a little bit. I don't know if you changed the position of your phone. But I'll tell you what, we're going to have to take a break. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're talking to Alexander Petrikov. He's a filmmaker, he's a traveler, and he's a cryptid researcher. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. And you are listening to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Granite Sky is proud to serve the Granite State, New England, and the world via the Internet with rock-solid support and personal services. There are many aspects to ufology, and the experiencer is too often overlooked.
At Granite Sky, their focus is on people, not proof. Granite Sky focuses on supporting those who have had extraterrestrial encounters and abduction experiences. We believe no one should have to face these experiences alone. If you've been visited, visit them at www.granitesky.org.
Yeah, welcome back to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. Tonight we're talking to documentary filmmaker, researcher, Alexander Petikoff. And just before we bring him back, I want to say if anybody wants to text a question or a comment, 603-430-9722. Welcome back, Alexander.
Welcome back, Alexander.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing the finished product of Lions, of the East. So that's, you say it's in post-production?
Yes, yeah, I'm hoping to have it done by the, before the end of the year here, November into December, so right around sort of, right before the holidays.
Good, so you've taken kind of a scientific approach on that?
Yeah, I mean, as a filmmaker, especially with documentaries, you know, I just try to be as objective as possible, and I try to lay out all the facts. I don't really dictate sort of a narrative. I just kind of, you know, tell the story as it is.
Present the facts.
That are involved, and kind of take it from that perspective, yeah.
Okay. Willie, you just had a question there.
I was just going to say, is there going to be a local premiere anywhere around here?
Possibly. I'm looking into that at the moment. I'm thinking about that. So certainly I will let you guys know. I'd love to have local folks show up. If I do end up doing it, you know, something maybe down the line. So we'll have to see.
All right.
Okay. Well, you've got a couple of other, documentaries that I'm pretty interested in kind of touching on tonight. But I want to get to CHAMP first. There's Lake Champlain and there's Lake Mifremagog. Now, you've done a documentary called On the Trail of CHAMP. And I really find that interesting. Some of the sightings or some of the reports, they're not exactly always synonymous, but there's definitely something being seen in both of those places, in Lake Champlain, which tends to be sort of a dinosaur-like creature with sort of a serpentine back. And then in Lake Mifremagog, which is actually part Canada, part, I don't know if that's into Vermont at all, but it's definitely mostly in Canada. They see a couple of different things there, and one of them is supposed to be a half-man, half-fish, which is covered with a slimy, dark gray skin, and it not only has gills, but it's seen as having nostrils. And then there's also something else that looks like a cross between an alligator and a fish. So really strange things, but continually there are these reports. And what is interesting about both of those lakes, they both source from the St. Lawrence Seaway. They turn into rivers, and at some point they're both very narrow, and then they wind up being lakes. And I'm thinking, you know, if they were around during the Ice Age, these creatures could have gotten landlocked in these deep lakes, or at least the deep sections of the lakes. So I think it's possible, that these creatures do exist. So what have you found out, especially about Lake Champlain, since you've studied that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's very interesting. I was always more interested in Loch Ness when I was younger, actually. You know, you grow up and you see the documentaries about Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. And It's funny because that was across the ocean, and I had Lake Champlain, you know, maybe 3-4 hours from me growing up. I never really thought about it that much, and every once in a while I'd pass through. But there didn't seem to be as much interest or research that was done on Lake Champlain. But once I sort of got an interest for it, and the cards kind of came together with working with Small Town Monsters, phenomenal sort of group of filmmakers and friends that I've had the fortune of working with, that and a crew that was sort of doing a CHAMP expedition, a friend of mine, the you know, dearly missed William Dranguinness, who passed away just last year, who was one of the stars of the series. You know, we kind of combined forces, and the documentary is born out of that, and that was really my first exposure to digging really deep into CHAMP. And, you know, I did the series over course of about 6 months with the editing and really diving into the research, and I became so mesmerized and fascinated by this body of water just from being there, from talking to eyewitnesses. And I thought, this interests me far more than even Loch Ness, which I had been to and was almost a bit of a letdown. And I think,
well, Loch Ness got a whole lot more press, I think, than Lake Champlain, don't you think?
It has.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the sort of evidence that's been put up for Loch Ness hasn't really withstood the test of time, and it's been a bit flimsy at times. And with Lake Champlain, I felt like there was just so much more to it, much bigger environment. And even since finishing the Champ series, I mean, the series was released last June of 2018. Since then, I've been going up to Vermont every couple of months and just hanging out by the lake. And my brother is in school up there now, so I really go up there a lot, and I'm always, you know, kind of checking out the lake. I mean, just a few weeks ago when I was moving him into school, I was up there getting some drone shots of the caves that are left over from the Champlain Sea era, which are now above ground. So with the series and the research I've kind of done beyond, I'm always very interested in Lake Champlain and the environment and how, as you mentioned, you know, this used to be part of this used to be connected actually to the ocean,
mm-hmm.
about 10,000-12,000 years ago, supposedly. That's what the science says.
Right.
This was connected to the ocean. You had whales, marine mammals, seals and beluga whales, all sorts of things. I mean, Vermont's state fossil is actually a beluga whale.
Whoa.
It was dug up on the shores of Lake Champlain when a railroad was being built in Charlotte, Vermont, and they dug up a whale skeleton, and that is now the state fossil. And that creature died during that period, and that was believed to be the period when human ancestors were moving into the area, and they would have hunted a lot of these marine creatures that lived in Lake Champlain, which was part of the sea, part of the Champlain Sea, a much larger environment. And the theory that a lot of the researchers have is that when the lake began, the waters began receding because of glacial movement north in Canada. So, I mean, this whole area had been covered in glaciers, but once the glaciers were freed up, that's when the sea was there for a period of a few thousand years. And once the glaciers kept moving north and north in Canada, the water levels rose, and the lake began to be cut off from the ocean directly and just connected in small sort of areas to the St. Lawrence. And the theory is perhaps that if there is a strange creature in Lake Champlain, it may have adapted from something. And there are fish that currently reside in the lake, like sturgeon,
right,
Atlantic salmon, possibly the lamprey, adapted from saltwater animals that made that shift, and now, you know, their ancestors were saltwater, and now they're freshwater animals. So it's possible that maybe something survived. And, you know, looking at the evidence, and especially talking about the eyewitnesses, I'm pretty sure that there's something. I don't know what it is, but some of the encounters are just very interesting and have led me to believe that some of these people really don't have anything to make up or gain by telling these stories. And it's a very, very interesting mystery, and it's kept me fascinated every time I go up there. Like I said, I'm still extremely fascinated.
Okay, so specifically regarding Champ, what are they reporting? What does this creature look like?
So a majority of sightings are sort of a typical lake monster appearance where there's a hump seen in the water.
Okay.
A lot of times what looks like multiple backs or humps coming out of the water. Mm-hmm. A lot of times what that is actually boat wakes that do look very conspicuous. I've seen wakes like that that upon a second glance you say, hey, what is that? I mean, that looks almost like a serpent-like back. So that's some of most of the sightings, you know, where people see just one hump and that sort of thing. And there are sturgeon in the lake that can get up to 14, 15 feet long. There's been, you know, I've been sent pictures.
But they're straight.
The inward of a 7-foot specimen pulled out just a couple of years ago that was a huge sturgeon. You know, you see the back of a sturgeon that's 10 feet long and you're in a 7-foot kayak. And that's by definition, that's going to be a monster to you. But there are other sightings that are far more intriguing. People that have seen creatures actually coming out of the water, a head and a neck that almost looks dinosaur-like.
Yeah.
Or sort of serpentine with a back.
Right.
A couple of underwater sightings of giant eel-like creatures, or even a few on-land sort of sightings. And famously a sighting right north of Burlington at the Charlie Hour Boathouse, where on multiple occasions two creatures were actually seen under a spotlight or a street light. It was above a boat ramp that connected right into the water. It was a boat launch right at the mouth of the Winooski River, where salmon go to spawn every year. A lot of these sightings kind of take place at the mouths of the rivers, but what these folks had seen was a smaller and a larger creature kind of wading in the water, right, illuminated by the light, that looked like dinosaur-like creatures on a couple of occasions. Very fantastical sighting, and other sightings in that area. Like I said, there have been a lot of the activity, a lot of sightings that have taken place at some of the rivers that feed into Lake Champlain, and there's about 7 or 8 big rivers that feed into the lake. So there's a lot of big fish that hang out in those areas, typically like sturgeon, salmon, like I mentioned, various other fish. So, you know, it's possible that a larger animal than there to feed. I mean, certainly that's where the big fish are there, because they're there to feed on the smaller fish. But there's something to feed on them, and that's where a lot of the sightings happen. So that's definitely interesting and something that I tended to notice and that I've been told by a lot of the researchers that are, you know, more focused on Chance specifically.
But have you heard any of the reports about the creatures seen in Lake Mefremagog, like the half-fish, half-human? Have you heard anything about that?
I can't say I've heard of the
no?
half-fish, half-human story, but I've heard certainly of the stories of Mefremagog, and they call them Memphrey, you know, that's sort of the... Each one of these lake monsters has a sort of cute moniker.
Yeah.
Whether it's Champ or Champy, Nessie, Ogopogo, the list goes on. Memphrey, so that lake is mostly...
Magog.
It juts into Vermont a little bit, and there are definitely sightings, but whatever it is in Lake Mefremagog, it seems to be more of like a large fish-like creature. That's what a lot of the sightings tend to describe. And it's a much smaller environment. Lake Champlain is 120-plus miles long, 12 miles wide, and it's wide.
Yeah, it's big.
Almost 400-something feet deep at its deepest, so it's called, actually, in a lot of ways, New England's West Coast, because it's a massive environment. It goes all the way from Canada to Whitehall, New York, which is more than 3/4 down the way to Vermont, or on the New York border. So it's a huge environment.
So is the movie at all conclusive? Put you on the spot.
Sorry?
Is the movie at all conclusive, your documentary on the Trail of Champ?
We didn't find proof that Champ existed, but we didn't find anything that said it didn't.
Okay.
As I sort of mentioned, my approach, I kind of tend to leave it open-ended, and I really make up their own minds, and I just want to get people interested in the mysteries, because you know, it was a 5-part series, and each episode covered a different facet of the mystery, so one was more about the history of the lake and how unusual the Lake Champlain is, and sort of the history of the sightings, and then episode 2 is more about the eyewitnesses and pieces of video that have been taken. 3 and 4 focus more specifically on the individual research groups. And episode number five is about the local impact of Champ. I mean, what it's done for some of the tourism. And
sure.
It's, you know, kind of known. It's not very well known, but the impact on the local community that celebrate it and use it as a mascot or something that they put on a lottery ticket. Vermont even has the minor league baseball team called the Lake Monsters, and their mascot is Champ. fun stuff like that. So, you know, with these mysteries, I mean, they really, lake monsters tend to encapsulate a lot, and they're very fascinating to us. There's lake monster stories across the world.
Yeah.
You know, many of them are, sadly, you know, not real creatures or not real phenomena. A lot of times they're created to create tourism. I mean, there's one I've just researched about in New Hampshire called Glennie that was in Goffstown, New Hampshire. It was sort of created to promote a race. You know, this was a swimming race they do every year. And this is, you know, just that sort of fun way to promote like a local story. But then you've got something like Champ or Nessie or Ogopogo or the Van Monster in Turkey, where there seems to be sightings that have been going on for centuries with lots of different legends and stories.
Mm-hmm. But there are things being seen anyway, things that can't really be explained. How about if we move on to Sasquatch? Now, you did Sasquatch Out of the Shadows. That came before your On the Trail of Bigfoot series, right?
Yeah, so that's sort of an open-ended series. It's actually a YouTube channel as well, where you can go on YouTube and watch the episodes or get a collection with the DVD. It's just sort of an open-ended series, just dealing with all sorts of Sasquatch questions. One episode will be about Bigfoot researchers in Ohio. Another one will be just a straight-up witness interview with people in Pennsylvania. I've got a couple in the books from when I was in Colorado and down in Arkansas and Louisiana. and other certainly local Bigfoot stories and legends. So it hasn't really concluded, but it's been going on, I guess, since 2016. And just kind of incrementally, I do a short documentary, or like I said, even just sort of a very minimally edited interview with just an eyewitness telling their story, mm-hmm. and just talking all about it. So,
well, in the course of interviewing all of these people, Alexander, are you getting a feeling from them that, of course, that there are differences in their sightings, but do you think the differences go to the extent of there being several different species of Bigfoot, of Sasquatch? This has been reported, but is that what you're finding?
You know, I don't really know. It seems like they're in different areas. There are different characteristics.
Yeah.
So down south, there tends to be more aggressive encounters, whereas in the Pacific Northwest, it's kind of the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot, where it's a lumbering giant in the woods, just shy. You know, in the Northeast as well, there's a mixture of those kind of reports. In the Midwest, it's different.
Yeah.
It seems to be sort of different appearances. Like down south, there tend to be smaller, shaggier hair, smellier, you know, hence the skunk ape in Florida.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, perhaps there's different sort of creatures or subspecies,
yeah, that's possible.
That have different adaptations. I mean, but I think there are certain encounters where there's almost paranormal angles, or even stories of three-toed creatures or creatures that have glowing red eyes that are quite different in nature than perhaps, you know, like most Bigfoot sightings. You know, I don't know the exact number, but I'll say, you know, 70, 80, 90% of all Bigfoot encounters are sort of pretty uniform in the sense that they're seeing a creature that's running away or trying to get away from them, or they have very similar behaviors, the rock throwing, the wood knocking, the howls, the whoops, sort of things like that.
What about the three-toed creatures, though? Are they associating that with a Bigfoot sighting?
Could you just repeat that?
You mentioned the three-toed creatures. Has that creature been associated with a Bigfoot sighting?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some. So, for example, one of the stories is the Honey Island Swamp Monster in Louisiana, and I looked into that when I was down there back in the spring. Where, you know, supposedly there were footprints found of a three-toed creature. And the local legend was that a circus train had crashed. Chimpanzees had escaped and had mated with alligators, producing some sort of strange hybrid. I mean, this was an old story. And as is often in a lot of these Bigfoot cases, there's a story about a circus train crashing and monkeys escaping. That tends to be a very common motif across, back when circus trains were a thing. So that's kind of why they think that there's 3 feet. I mean, that story obviously doesn't sound very plausible. That would be medically impossible. But some people have suggested that examples of three toes or less digits than perhaps five would be maybe an example of inbreeding or genetic malformities or sort of things that can happen in humans. I mean, with human beings, there's all sorts of genetic disorders and things that can produce very strange things in people.
But three toes are usually associated with some kind of a reptoid.
Yes, yeah, and that's kind of, I think, with that story specifically in Louisiana, the connection they made with the alligators. But, you know, I'm not going to say whether or not I think the particular footprints are authentic, but I think there's been some scrutiny put on those particular footprints. But there have been cases in Falk, Arkansas, the Boggy Creek Monster, supposedly the discovery of a couple of three-toed tracks and other three-toed tracks. But yeah, it seems like there are a small percentage of Bigfoot sightings that do involve other strange things, especially in areas like Pennsylvania and some other parts of the country, you know, where there's just very weird sort of things going on at the same time.
Aberrations of sightings. Aberration of an aberration.
It's tough to say because, you know, having just talked to probably at this point dozens upon dozens of people who have claimed to see Bigfoot, for the most part, like I said, just from my own personal anecdotal evidence, you know, in terms of speaking to eyewitnesses, vast majority of them have been what you'd expect from like a biological creature, in the sense that they were just trying to get away from me, or they were doing this or that, and they exhibited behaviors that, you know, I've heard about in other encounters halfway across the country, or in the Pacific Northwest or in Alaska or wherever, but there have been a subset where people claim that there was other things going on, orbs being seen or even sort of balls of light and these kinds of things. Mm. So, there may be multiple things going on. I don't really know. I think a lot of what my own personal beliefs have shifted in the past year or so just based on strange encounters that I've had, you know, such as a very weird UFO encounter we had in Pennsylvania with Paul Eno and Shane Sirway and the crew we have out there investigating one of these sort of flap areas, because, you know, we had seen this object and got it on film, and it's in this area where people see this kind of stuff all the time, along with Bigfoot, orbs, strange things in the sky, black helicopters, lots of military interest in these, supposedly in these kinds of areas. So there may be more going on than just meets the eye, but I'm always interested in a good Sasquatch eyewitness story or encounters, especially older stories that people tell, you know, the great grandparents or loggers in the area, first settlers, even the Native American lore.
Yeah, we're familiar with the Pennsylvania investigation with Paul.
Yeah.
And Paul claims to have seen a Bigfoot out there. Did you see anything yourself?
So, no, I didn't see a Bigfoot. I know Paul, I've been to this particular case 2 years in a row now. So this past May and May before that, that's when I was brought on. Before that, Shane and Paul and Ben had been there a number of times.
Right.
Both claimed to have some kind of strange Bigfoot-like experience, whereas neither of them had really been particularly interested in those subjects before that point. And afterwards, of course, very fascinated in it. I came into it primarily interested in the Bigfoot angle because I had heard some of the stories coming from that area. And last year I conducted an interview with Chuck Credo as well, who kind of joined our team, where we interviewed three generations of a family that lived on this particular property that we're in, down by the end of the ravine where there's been a lot of sightings, and they have had sightings, three generations worth, in that family where they were seeing juvenile Bigfoots, they were seeing larger creatures, they were having strange noises at night, terrifying them all night long, creatures in the woods mimicking their chickens when their chickens would be put away at night, very kind of strange stuff like that.
Was that in Maine?
No, that was the Pennsylvania.
You're talking about Chuck Credo. Was he talking about a family from Maine, or was that Pennsylvania?
He was with us in Pennsylvania.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
I'm saying we had interviewed a family in particular in Pennsylvania, but, you know, we have these town hall meetings where we'll have locals from the community come in, and a lot of them told us about their Bigfoot encounters that first year I was there. And then this year we went, you know, we had another town hall. We heard about more Bigfoot sightings, and, you know, Pennsylvania is now one of these Bigfoot hotspots. It was, I think, third or fourth best state in the country for Bigfoot sightings, apparently. So there's, you know, we had a restaurant town hall, and the restaurant was Bigfoot themed and all kinds of stuff. But this year when we went, we had this UFO experience. And I had never really been particularly interested in UFOs as much as I had in other subjects like cryptozoology. You know, it was always kind of in my periphery. You know, I was interested in the phenomenon and that, but that sort of changed my perspective a little bit based on what we saw out there. So it's funny, as I said, Paul and Shane went into it not interested in Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Came out with that, and I was kind of the opposite. I started with the Bigfoot. Now I'm definitely interested in the UFO phenomenon, but I never closed the door to any of these sort of subjects.
No.
Picking areas that interest me more, but it seems like there's always something that kind of pulls you in another direction, which is fine because, you know, it's always, there's enough interesting things in the world to investigate.
Okay, now on Bigfoot, I got to ask you the question. Since nobody can ever actually see him and the tracks end and all that stuff, the interdimensional thing, where do you stand on that?
I don't know. I'm a little bit skeptical, I guess, of that just because I think it's a little bit too convenient, perhaps, of an answer. Sometimes people lean on that a little bit,
right,
especially in the modern sense where the lack of evidence must mean that it's, you know, paranormal or supernatural. Like I said, majority of people that anecdotally that I've spoken to, in addition to having read dozens of books by much more well-seasoned and experienced researchers than myself, a vast majority of the sightings are behaviors that you'd expect from a biological creature. But like I said, there's a percentage that definitely have stranger things going on, and I'm not going to say that I 100% cancel that theory out.
Right.
But I think overwhelmingly it seems that there's more of a biological bend. Now, I mean, what even is, what is reality? You know, we often ask ourselves this question. There are certain things that perhaps in the past may have seemed totally mystical. You know, if you're trying to explain Wi-Fi signal or, you know, how I can communicate with somebody across the world instantly on Facebook Messenger to somebody 200 years ago, they might accuse you of being a sorcerer. So perhaps there are certain biological traits that certain animals that have that we just cannot understand at the moment. They may have a, you know, maybe that is what is truly paranormal. It's just it's out of our experience. We don't really understand what it is. So, but maybe it's totally normal. It's just we don't know what it is. That's why for us, paranormal. I mean, there are certain behaviors in animals today, such as echolocation, which whales, elephants, various species use. These are frequencies that we cannot hear, we cannot detect.
Yeah.
Yet these animals use them almost like a Wi-Fi signal. I mean, and this could be described as magical in a certain sense, but it's a perfectly normal behavior in for these creatures that utilize it. So maybe something like a Sasquatch has learned how to sort of utilize its environment to blend in ways that we just can't understand. I don't know. I'm not saying I know the answers, but you know, it's always tough to try and answer a mystery with another question.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
On the last show, Alexandra, I had asked you if you'd read any books by Kwoni Lapsaritis. He's got two out, one particular, the Psychic Sasquatch. He claims to communicate with them. He claims to have seen them. And he kind of believes that there are five species and that some of them are interdimensional. That's coming from him. But have you read any of his books? He's got two out.
I have not. No, I tend to be a little bit on the skeptical side of people who claim to have all the answers.
No, he doesn't, but he does interact with them.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I just haven't really looked into it that much. Typically tend to kind of go my own path, I sense, in a sense, you know, kind of unconventionally in a way. And really just, I base a lot of you know, my belief system kind of on my experiences. And like I said, a lot of my anecdotal experiences, and you know, it's just been kind of very interesting for me. It's been fascinating to see the kind of evolution and what I've thought about the subject, and you know, being much more open to it and having strange experiences that, you know, are very fascinating, but not being able to conclusively, you know, 100% say everything you hear out of the woods is a Sasquatch. I think a lot of times people kind of fall into that trap a little bit because they get so into the subject that they're almost, maybe they've had one experience and then everything suddenly becomes that. I just think we need to be careful with that and just sort of take a step back and be critical of even our own experiences and interpretations of what may have happened.
The blaster casts that you usually have with you at different, you know, presentations and whatnot, have you taken those yourself? I mean, have you seen any Sasquatch footprints yourself?
Not myself personally. I've been sent various pictures.
Okay.
The cats are,
I was just curious.
Yeah. Bigfoot, you know, sightings from across the country, and you know, I like to have those displayed, and they're fun for people to see, and I'll have them on display at the Leominster Conference now, the Greater New England UFO Conference. I'm doing a couple library talks as well next week. I have a talk on lake monsters in New England at the Derry Public Library in New Hampshire. And then the following week, I have a talk in the Portsmouth Public Library about the Grand State Bigfoot. So,
yeah, and I plan to be at that one.
Yeah, excellent. Hope to see you there.
Yeah. Hey, we're just about out of time, Alexander.
Yeah, well,
yeah, it always does, right? And I just want to say that the documentaries are excellent. You're a great filmmaker, and actually, Alex helped me out not too long ago with a little project that I was doing, drone stuff for me. Did a great job on that.
That was fun. It was very cool to check the ship out.
Yeah, that's been a fun project.
Yeah, I wish you luck with that as well.
No, thank you. Sometime in the spring, I will invite you to the premiere.
Ooh.
I look forward to it.
What was I going to say?
Oh, website.
Yes, my website's pedikovmedia.com. That's TETAKOVmedia.com. Everything's on there. I just got a new batch of these awesome New England cryptid stickers that have Sasquatch Champ and the Dover Demon on them. So I'll have those at upcoming events. And you know, just, that's a good place to my website, is just to find links to everything. And you can watch the Bigfoot stuff on YouTube for free and other stuff as well.
Great, great.
Okay. And the Portsmouth, that's next week. What was the date? Was it next Thursday, was it?
The Portsmouth Bigfoot talk is on the 10th, or the 9th, actually, which is October 9th. Lake Monster talk in Derry is October 2nd, and then I will be at the Greater New England Greater New England UFO Conference the 4th and 5th of October. I'm speaking on the 4th. And on the panel on the 4th as well.
Oh, great.
All right.
Great. Well, thank you very much. This has been quite enlightening.
Yes.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, we thank you. It's always great to have you, and hopefully next time you'll be able to come in again.
Yeah, that would be nice.
So.
Very, very great. All right. Thank you so much, Alexander. You have a good evening.
Yeah, see you next week.
And you as well.
All right. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Good night. All right, Alexander Petikoff, documentary filmmaker.
He sees a lot of interesting stuff.
He does. He sees and does a lot of interesting stuff in all over the world.
Here's a lot of interesting stuff.
Next week we have, do you remember?
What is it called?
Put you on the spot.
Yeah, I believe it's a hypnotist. I believe it's Rod
Stewart. No, that's 2 weeks. Next week is...
Hold on, I'll have it in a second.
I shouldn't have brought it up, huh?
Dylan Jones.
Dylan Jones.
He does ghost tours in London, but he also has some experience. He was a constable for about 17 years in England, and he's gone over to the paranormal side.
And actually, he's doing a documentary, too. He's,
is he?
Yeah, partly on UK paranormal, and he's going to come over here. And actually, I think he got here today.
Over here to the States, yeah.
Massachusetts. And I believe he's going to be continuing filming here. He's going to be in Portsmouth.
And he's going to be in our studio
next
Wednesday.
Wednesday he will be here.
So that'll be a pleasure.
Okay.
All
so,
right.
I guess that's Spirit Radio.
That about wraps Spirit Radio up for tonight. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and you have a good evening.
You have been listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, with your hosts Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Granite Sky is proud to serve the Granite State, New England, and the world via the Internet with rock-solid support and personal services. There are many aspects to ufology, and the experiencer is too often overlooked. At Granite Sky, their focus is on people, not proof. Granite Sky focuses on supporting those who have had extraterrestrial encounters and abduction experiences. We believe no one should have to face these experiences alone. If you've been visited, visit them at www.granitesky.org.